two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. This is part two of our interview with Alf Wren.
I try to keep quite an open mind, so I often, I still kind of keep in touch with what HBR is writing and what the friends in Stanford are doing. But I also do think that for a person who works with innovation and creativity, it's also important to kind of look up stuff that you're not really.
Alf, for anybody who might have missed part one, can you tell us a little bit about your career and the book that's coming out? Just a quick overview for somebody who missed part one.
Yeah. Well, my name is Alf Wren. I'm an academic in innovation. I'm a professor of innovation, design, and management. And I've often worked kind of in that in-between space between innovation and criticism or critique. So I work a lot with criticizing simple ideas about innovation and trying to kind of develop innovation thinking. And that's kind of the foundation of a book I'm doing now called Innovation for the Fatigued. It's about how we can make our cultures more attuned to deep creativity and not just shallow such.
And I'm really interested, especially in a little bit of what we talked about in this theme of the first episode about listening to the folks who are actually doing the work instead of thinking it's only executives who can have good ideas. You mentioned that Tata was an organization that was good at this. Do you know any specifics or any stories?
Well, Tata has obviously what they've done is that obviously Tata is a big conglomerate, so they're doing a lot of different things. But what they were early on in doing was that they were really trying to understand their end users and also be very inclusive about their end users. So when they were kind of talking about developing, for instance, the Tata car, which was supposed to be the cheapest ever, they actually went to people in the organization that came from what in India would be considered kind of less privileged backgrounds, and really took them serious and started asking. So, okay, so would you need this? Is this a good way to go? So even in a society so still afflicted by notions of hierarchy and class, they understood that having this diversity in the organization is a strength, and it's a strength that can be used strategically. And I think that there's an important lesson there for too often. I mean, even look at this conversation. It's two kind of white guys from a decent kind of backgrounds and with kind of fine educations and all that. I mean, too easily our conversation can be just about people like us. But there's so much more to life. I mean, there's so many more people we could talk to, engage with, people from different backgrounds. Obviously different ethnicities, differences in gender, or even the gender non-binary. And I think that this richness of ideas, this richness of what Clay Shirky has called the cognitive surplus, we still have so much mining to do there and still so many great innovations we can create if we truly kind of connect with this.
Yeah. And who is the organization in China that you had mentioned?
That's Haier. They're one of the biggest makers of whitewares in China. They make, for instance, fridges and the likes, washing machines. And they are in a kind of an almost constant state of reimagining their business. And the CEO of Haier, a man whose name unfortunately escapes me now because I even though I stayed in China for some time, I still struggle with remembering Chinese names. I have difficulty enough with my kids. He is very adamant on every person in the organization being empowered to actually push ideas forward, that people can actually spend money to test out ideas. They're a very experiment-driven culture. And as a result, have grown tremendously and made the owner a very, very rich man.
Can we talk about this for a second? Because in speaking about innovation, it's very easy for managers or other leaders to spout off, you know, we want people to take more risks. And if you're not failing at something every month here, you're not doing your job. But then by giving people a lack of boundaries, folks don't know how far they can push things. And then you see other folks like in the hospitality industry, some of the high-end hotels will say something like, you can make a decision in favor of any guest up to $100 without talking to anybody in management. And they've given them some boundaries to know where the left and right limits are because, you know, small failures are great if you learn. Big failures are not great, right? If you're And so helping people know, like, what is the appropriate amount of experimentation and giving people some examples to base their choices off instead of saying, hey, it's a wild open field, go for the blank canvas. You know, that's scary.
It is scary, but I mean, I think often the problem is even deeper than you kind of outline. I completely agree with you that the best case scenario is one where everyone would know just how much they can use, where three people can come together and combine, in a sense, their this kind of resource usage and create something greater. But what I run into quite often is that you'll have a CEO who goes, I want my people to be risk takers. And then you turn around and realize he's just fired two people for taking risks. And that kind of behavior is far more prevalent than we often like to talk about, where the top management of an organization might sing innovation's praises, but actually then behave in ways that completely contradict this and are very strict about KPIs and seemingly you can do whatever you want as long as it's immediately successful and doesn't take any time either. And, I mean, it's just like if you'd have a parent like that who says, yes, you're free to do whatever you wish, but if you come 5 minutes after the time I allotted for you, I will beat you up. You wouldn't become a very freewheeling kid, would you? You'd become a very scared kid. You'd become kind of traumatized by what your parent just said to you because it doesn't seem to make sense. It is schizophrenic.
Yeah, so knowing that leaders aren't doing that intentionally, right? But yet, you know, kind of the like, I can't hear what you said over the thunder of your actions type of thing definitely takes over. So again, as you think about any of us who want to work on ourselves to audit ourselves and see if our actions line up with our words or things like this, any thoughts, any advice?
This is, and I'm not the first, I mean, I'm one of the last people who speaks the praises often of innovation consultants, because having done this for quite a while, I've seen so many bad ones. But this is, of course, one of the points where an innovation consultant actually can do a lot of good. Not by delivering, this is what you should do to innovate, but rather as being the guy who speaks truth to power, or the gal who speaks truth to power. And the person who can say, yeah, you do know you're the problem. And that, of course, takes guts from the consultant's side, because that might mean that the consultant gets fired. But I've had the honor and scary situation of telling, for instance, a big chemical company's CEO and saying, well, I can identify your company's problem in innovation culture. It's you. It's all you. You create this notion of innovation, and then you basically scare everyone into submission and wonder what went wrong. He didn't take it well. I got screamed at a lot. But the benefit of being an academic and a full-time one at that is that I didn't need his money really. So I said, well, you cannot pay me. I'm fine. I'm still going to be able to feed my kids. You wanted me to tell the truth, and there's the truth. If you don't like that, that's not really my problem. That's more your problem. And we got over that hump. He kind of realized what I was saying, and we actually got some positive change going. But sometimes that's what you need. You don't need one more innovation model or business model canvas. You need somebody to go in and say, listen, it's a culture thing. It's a language thing. Sometimes it's even a clear kind of leadership issue at the top.
Well, this is what I want to talk about. Let's take a quick break, hear from our sponsor, and then I want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So Alf, before the sponsor break here, you talked about how it's not typically a problem of people don't have enough innovation tools, that it has much more to do with the culture and how things are done around here. When you think about the biggest levers or the first things leaders can do to work on that culture, because, you know, culture is another, if innovation is a buzzword, culture is at least as big a buzzword, right?
Absolutely.
But when you have observed folks actually make progress in having the kind of culture that is more likely to invite everybody to bring their brain to work instead of just the executives who think they're the ones who are supposed to have the good ideas and reset that tone and create new habits, or what's an organization that to you has done it well, or what's any thoughts you have about this?
Well, it's to begin with, I think it needs to be said that to build a strong innovation culture takes a very long time. You couldn't be one of the great companies that have managed because they're just built on the strong innovation culture from the start. So I was talking to the CEO of Pixar, who's a great guy and runs an organization where there is really freedom for everyone to kind of pitch in and talk that. But I also pointed out to him that, well, when you grow from that, it's easier than when you have an actually problematic organization you try to kind of reinvent. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the my most kind of happiest times I've actually had was working with a company, a bank actually, or a financial institution, a financial warehouse almost, that really struggled with the fact that a lot of people there kind of showed innovation fatigue, and particularly very few of the women wanted to participate. And when we started working on this, I kind of said that, well, actually, where you go wrong, it's not really even something you say, it's all your micro behaviors. Because I'd been observing them in meetings, particularly in innovation pitch meetings. And a lot of what I saw was them kind of people squirming in chairs, people checking out Facebook while other people are pitching ideas, people yawning completely unashamedly when some junior person was raising an issue. And I said, this is your problem. It's not that you're being mean or you don't allocate enough resources. It's that you yawn at that young kid who actually was trying to speak to you. And they, again, got a little miffed because they, oh, well, yeah, I'm not allowed to yawn if I'm tired. I said, you're allowed to yawn, but you're also allowed to think about how little things like the way you behave in a meeting is actually constitutive of how culture works. And we ran this little exercise in which people got to come. They put the top executive team behind a screen so they couldn't see who was talking. And people actually came in and told stories about times they felt disrespected or patronized or put down in the organization. And it wasn't the most pleasant exercise I've run because it got heavy. I mean, the top executives team sit there and literally one of them almost started crying because it was hard to hear this stuff. But it was also cleansing. I mean, they understood that there was a deep and severe problem in their culture and that was killing ideas on a weekly basis. And when you realize the problem, and this is kind of old AA material, when you understand the problem, you can start to work on the problem. When you realize this is what we have to work from, this is where we have to start building and rebuilding from, then it's much easier than to get speed from stuff like, for instance, new innovation models or a new process and the likes, because you're aware and you're reflective about what's going on.
I love that story. Can we break it down just a little bit? So the folks who were sharing this, you know, stories of when they've been disrespected. They knew that there were executives behind the screen,
yes,
but they didn't know who?
They knew there were executives, and I told them that there were several of the top executives. Actually, most of the team was there. But I also had made sure that the most of the people actually telling these stories were so low down in the hierarchy that there was no way anyone in the executive team would recognize their voices, particularly not behind a screen. We are not that good at recognizing voices, we human beings. And I'd also had a commitment from the top executive team that no retributive action would be taken. So it was a controlled process. But they were basically speaking to me. They kind of knew somebody else was behind the screen. But I'm by keeping kind of eye contact with me and by me asking questions, they very quickly became basically a conversation between me and them, with the executive team just as kind of quiet listeners in the background.
And what industry was this?
Finance. Banking.
And was that in North America or over in Europe or?
This was in Europe. It was actually in the Nordics. It was a delightful bank with fearsome lawyers, which I will not name.
I mean, what's fascinating about that to me is this idea of the humanness of that, mm-hmm. right? When people can hear such specifics, the idea of, you know, trying to hold on to your blind spot about it becomes much more difficult with that level of direct human interaction, right?
And also, just as you said, culture can be such a buzzword. Anyone can say that, yes, we have an encouraging culture where it's people first. But then when you hear about this girl kind of explain that she felt invisible or she felt humiliated when she was trying to kind of come with a suggestion for an innovation project and everyone started laughing at her. And then you realize, oh, shit, pardon my French, we're an organization which literally laughs at underlings when they try to help. It's that kind of really hits home for some people.
Yeah. And do you know anything about after that session, any steps they took or anything that changed?
I'm still in touch with them from time to time. They have developed their culture considerably. They admit openly that, well, they are still a bank and they're still relatively traditional and they could do better, but they're working on it. And I always say to clients that don't expect to become Apple or any other of these hailed super companies in an instant. It's a long journey. It's just like it's a long journey for us humans to kind of try to develop and understand why we're put on this earth. It's a long journey for a culture to go from being so-so to be truly great. And you should allow for the organization, too, to take time to grow and to become better.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thanks for sharing that story. I think there's a lot in that for the rest of us to maybe consider about our own organizations. I liked the way we ended the first episode so much. I think I want to do a repeat with our remaining time here. I want to hear some more of the folks that you think are some of the smartest thinkers out there, or the people that you're really enjoying being influenced by.
Well, I try to keep quite an open mind, so I often I still kind of keep in touch with what HBR is writing and what the friends in Stanford are doing. But I also do think that for a person who works with innovation and creativity, it's also important to kind of look up stuff that you're not really, you don't understand as well. So for instance, right now I'm reading on childhood quite a lot. I'm reading on how childhood has been understood over the ages and over times.
Any particular authors or anybody you'd recommend there?
There is Lydia Martens, is a young scholar who just came out with a great book on childhood and markets, which very academic, but which I truly, truly enjoyed. And then there is a great new book on strategy, which I think everyone with an interest in business should be reading. And it's not strategy in corporate strategy, but it's on grand strategy. And that's John Lewis Gaddis's book, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Really one of those deep dives into what strategy has meant through the ages and how presidents and kings have deployed strategic thinking.
And what's sometimes that one called?
It's called On Grand Strategy.
Okay.
And John Lewis Gaddis's came out on Penguin Press this year. And it's one of those deep dives where you realize that even though you work with corporate strategy for quite a number of years, there's still so much to learn and there's still so many to learn from.
I love it. We got time for maybe two more.
One of my personal things that I always do to try to keep intellectually alive is I also always read books that really don't connect to either business or strategy or anything, just freely, what I call free reading. And one of the things right now is I read a lot of cookbooks. That might seem odd, but I've always been interested in cuisine and the likes. And there is a cookbook by a rap star called Action Bronson, a very curious rap star who's Albanian-American and also actually a trained chef. And I'm not sure I can say the name on your podcast, okay. But it would the cleaned up version would be Heck, That's Delicious.
Okay.
And I truly like reading when people are innovative in their space, be that space rap music or food or sports or whatever, because I think that as business folks, we really need to extend our minds far beyond just the business world. And sometimes the best input we can have to help our clients or to teach our students is to read about food, to read about history, or just to read fiction. Great fiction can teach you a tremendous amount about creative thinking and innovation.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Stephen Johnson's book, Where Good Ideas Come From?
I am. I actually reviewed that at one point.
Okay.
It's a very fun book and really got me thinking about frogs. he mentions frogs somewhere, and I remember writing up a little thing about...
is that the frog hearts where they connected the vagus nerve through the saline solution, maybe?
Yeah. But then I started thinking about how frogs live and die, and kind of that as a metaphor for ideas and how we kind of approach ideas in organizations. But frankly, I can't even remember what my point was with that little text. I just remember he got me thinking about frogs.
You know, it really influenced this show so much, his idea of liquid networks. And, mm-hmm. you know, like today on the show, as soon as you and I are done here, we're going to have the head of a Formula One team who's racing in the Formula E, the all-electric race cars, mm-hmm. who used to be a head designer for McLaren. And, you know, this idea of the show specifically, like, you know, musicians and filmmakers and then people from the nonprofit space and PhDs like yourself and authors and trying mm-hmm. to almost like invent my own liquid network of, by having such different people on the show, trying to see, you know, who's got an idea, who's got a conception that could be adapted to my world. And, so it's interesting to hear the way that you approach it and kind of makes me want to look up that cookbook.
I have a friend, a Swedish, sometime rock star, sometimes podcaster, Navid Modiri. He runs a podcast solely around inviting people he disagrees with. And it sounds like the most combative podcast ever, but it's actually rather sweet because he doesn't invite them to yell at them, but instead he invites them to truly try to understand why they do what they do and think what they think. And I listen to that at times and listen to this man whom I know is one of the most hardcore anti-racists in the world, who has has an Iranian background, and him calmly and in an understanding fashion talk to a neo-Nazi. it kind of makes you think about what creativity can truly be when we try to be respectful and try to be open-minded.
That's amazing. And what's that show called?
It's actually in Swedish only, I'm afraid. So I don't think you'll benefit, but Navid Modiri is a nice guy to check up regardless.
Okay. That's super interesting. Well, listen, so besides people going to your website, which is alfrehn.com, where else is good places for people to connect with you or find your books? Or?
Well, the website's good. You can also hook me up on Twitter and Instagram. I think I have the maximum amount of friends I can have on Facebook, so that can be a little tricky, and I mainly use that to gab with my friends, often in Finnish or Swedish. But Twitter, where it's @alfrehn, or Instagram, where it's the exact same thing, are both great avenues where I'm certain to put up far more pictures of my book than anyone will ever want to see.
When is it supposed to come out, the new one?
Now I'm actually slightly delayed. I should send in the final manuscript at the end of this week, and I'm still think that the publisher is still hoping for an April release.
Okay. Well, you'll have to let us know, and we'll send an email out to people on the list, and they can see it then.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again for making time for this.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
Well, that's it for the episode. One other thing I wanted to tell you about. If you remember the guys from Convoy in episodes back, Ken Free and Trent Mano, I went on one of their CEO trips to New York, and I met a guy named Brent Thompson, very successful entrepreneur. He was former CEO of Jive Communications, big company now, I think $300 or $400 million. Anyways, he started a new company called BlipBillboards.com. I'm super stoked they're a sponsor now. But I remember a year and some ago when I met him, I thought it was genius. Instead of having to buy 6 months or a year's worth of billboard for thousands of dollars, you can buy 8 seconds at a time for like 10 or 20 cents. You pick what billboard you want it on, what time of day you want it to run. And it just puts so much power in the hands of marketers and CEOs who want to try something and see if it works. You can buy as many or as few as you want, change it as many times as you want. I think now our podcast is being advertised on billboards in like 18 different states because we have these guys as sponsors. We're pretty excited about it. Hope you check out blipbillboards.com. Thanks.